Welcome to It Is What It Is. I'm Shaw Marie. Hopefully everybody's having a good start to their week. So to start out with, I guess we should say that next week's episodes are going to be different. I think we'll probably take away or maybe even keep the Thursday one only because Mr. Wood was in court yesterday, and Mr. Wood is the prosecutor for the state of Idaho in the Lori and Chad saga nonsense. And so they were in front of the courts yesterday because he doesn't want there to be any video coverage of the hearings that are coming up. And shockingly, her team and Mr. Daybell and all of them are on the same page that we as Americans have the right to witness and see what the evidence is against these people. And I really believe that Mr. Daybell and them did it mainly only because they knew that they are already hated enough. And so to agree, I think they knew would push people over the fucking edge. And pretty much the judge said, in all words but not these words, that if he does not allow the cameras in, and he has to open up the doors to the public, because you cannot tell the public that we cannot hear or see a hearing. Well, you can say we can't see it, but like everybody has the right to see what they're accusing these people of and see the evidence of what they have, to be scrutinized by the people is an easier way to put it. We all have that right. And so the judge pretty much was like, and if I don't fucking do that, you all know that this case is already so big and so publicized that anarchy and terror will rain down upon cute little Rexburg, Idaho, and it just ain't gonna be no good for nobody. So no fear, we're going to. So Monday and Tuesday is Chad's court. They say it's only going to be 2 days, but we'll see. My main question for everyone is, do you want the reaction afterward? Or, since I have some time, should I figure out how to video myself and watch it so we can watch it together? Does that make sense? Maybe. Who knows? Tell me, what do you guys want? Everybody seems to like my Lori Vallow and them recaps. So, and I know I got a lot of people listening, especially just from listening to those. So tell me how you guys want it. If you guys want it, we can go live and do it that way, or the video after. I really don't care. I just know I'm going to have a ton to say, especially about Chad. So, yeah, let me know. Okay, so this other one, sorry, that was 3 minutes of non-case related talking. Everybody's going to get butt hurt. So let's jump right into the other one. Okay, so this one is from Netflix, and I stumbled upon it. I had never seen it, and I stumbled upon it. I love it. I cried. This family got me. And it just goes to show that once again, you can go to jail for doing nothing wrong. And that when you put someone in jail when they have done nothing wrong, things severely do happen to these people. So I'm just going to tell you guys this story about this amazing family and this wonderful man and what happened to him. And hopefully he's doing good now. I couldn't find anything real recent on how he's doing, and I would love to hear that this guy is doing really good, because it gets really close to home in a lot of ways, mainly because there's a sister and a brother and siblings, and you know, me and my siblings pull at my heartstrings. But the sister in this case snuck the brother into the bar for a night of fun. Okay, we have fun, we leave. What they say happened on this night is a result of all of that. So it just really touched a home. And what your family will do for you when they know beyond a reasonable doubt what you have are. Well, they know what you are, who you are, what is inside of you. And they know that if something is wrong and you are wrongfully convicted of something, that your family and your heart of hearts, they will fight for you till the end of days. And that's how it truly, truly should be. So I'm going to tell you the story of the Ferguson family, and their movie / documentary is called Dream / Killer. It was made in 2015. Like I said, it's on Netflix. We have about 13 pages of notes here. And so it's going to be, we'll see how long it actually turns out to be. And we'll dive right in. I'm going to give you guys like the main characters that we're going to talk about. And then we will, yeah, talk about the whole thing. And then, like I said, if anybody knows this guy or anybody in this family, please, please, please tell me how he's doing. Because I've literally thought nothing but of him since I watched this like 3 days ago, and he's just really stayed with me, and I just, oh man. Okay, so I'm going to tell you guys, we'll get into it, and we will start off with introducing the family. And the family consists of Bill, Leslie, Kelly, and Ryan. And like I said before, they are the Ferguson family. And also comes into this will be Chuck, or Charles is his actual name, Erickson. And then we have a fucked up prosecutor too, and then we have an amazing lawyer, but we'll get to them later on down the road. Okay, so obviously from what I've told you so far, you get that one of these men, the family guy, is wrongfully convicted. So this is the story of Ryan and Chuck, mainly Ryan, but Chuck. I will not call him Chuck later on in the episode, but like I said, it'll be self-explanatory when we get there. Okay, so on October 31st, Halloween, of 2001, a reporter got killed, Mr. Highholt. And in Michigan, or is it Michigan or Missouri? Missouri. In Missouri, the state of Missouri, sorry, this is the only unsolved murder at the time in this town, okay? And I should have wrote down the town, but I didn't write down the exact town. But the only unsolved murder at the time. So obviously, when crime happens there, it's very rare, okay? Murder, I should say. Crime, obviously, is all sorts of crime. So, both of these guys, Ryan and Chuck, are both 17 years old at the time. And in the state of Missouri, you can get, that means you're an adult. So, you can, if you commit a crime bad enough, you can be charged as an adult. And that's perfectly fine. Which, I hate when, I just always have to always try to overcorrect myself, because all those sensitive ass people in the world who want to correct me on every little thing I say, I try to do it for them. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to try to stop doing that. Anywho, so what happens is there's an anniversary publishing of this newspaper article about Mr. Highholt, and it's 2 years later on his 2 year anniversary. So it is now 2003. Well, Chuck has been going around for a while talking to his friends, telling his friends that he had a dream that he did it and Ryan was a part of this crime. So he's telling all these people. The documentary starts out with a 911 call that Chuck makes to 911, and he's like, hey, I have some information for you, or whatever. And he goes to the cops, and the cops go, and Ryan comes on, and Ryan is a very handsome fella. If you don't like true crime, do it for looks alone. Very handsome guy. he comes on the screen and he starts telling his story that, like, he was going home. A truck with two guys in it was following him. They followed him into his apartment complex. When they got out, they arrested him. It was the FBI or something like that. So, like, he tells his story. So they go, and when you watch Chuck's interrogation video, and he's being told what happened through this whole thing. So, like, they take him back to the scene. And normally when you're taken back to the scene being the quote-unquote killer, you're the one who's like, hey, it happened over there, 3 steps to the left, 2 steps right, exact same spot. But no. In this situation, they're telling Chuck. They're like, hey, you see that gray car over there? What you did happened, like, right behind that spot. And he's like, oh, okay. And then they're like, well, how did Ryan kill him? Because he says Ryan killed him. He says he hits him in the back of the head with a tire iron, and that Ryan is the one who does the final killing of it all. And he says, oh, I saw him strangle him with a shirt or something. And the cop is like, well, bro, I know it's not a shirt. And he's like, okay, maybe a bungee cord. Maybe something out of the car. I don't think it was a rope. Why would the guy have a rope in the car? And the cop's like, well, I'll tell you what it is. I'll tell you right now for a fact. We know that his belt was taken off of him and that he was strangled with his own belt. And even Chuck himself goes, oh, really? Like, in the tone of like, what the fuck? Really? That's his tone. And so he's piecing all this together. Meanwhile, they're telling Chuck, they're like, dude, I hope you know Ryan's in the other room over there, singing like a canary. And he's already thrown you under the bus 4 or 5 times. And he's writing a statement. He's going to be the first one to get a deal and all this shit. And so Chuck's like, oh, ho, 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 no, 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 no. Chuck gets the deal, right? So he flips on Ryan. He's like, I will tell you everything that Ryan did. You say Ryan did it, Ryan did it. I know I did it too, but I know Ryan killed this dude. So they have their number one witness against Ryan now in the form of Chuck. Okay? So Chuck was charged with second-degree murder, okay? Ryan was charged with first-degree murder, which is could be penalized up to life in prison without parole or death, okay? In his interrogation, in Ryan's interrogation, the parts that they show you in the documentary, just in that little part alone, I counted 11 times that he says, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. If Chuck did it, because he was with Chuck that night. And he says, if Chuck did it, dude, I don't know when or where he was. Because he was not with me. We did not do this. And he's even like, dude, Chuck's a weird motherfucker. You guys have talked to him for a second. Y'all obviously know. He's weird. And 11 times in that little clip, dude, and he's not just saying, I don't know. I don't know. He's telling them, like, yeah, you guys might be right, but you're wrong about my involvement. I, Ryan Ferguson, do not know dick. And he says that, dude, multiple times. And even one piece of shit cop comes in, because Ryan is really close with his dad. And he's like, I can't even talk to my dad. Ryan says that. And this one dick cop comes in, and he's like, hey, let me step in for your dad. And his dad's an amazing guy. There's no stepping in for Ryan's dad, Bill. No stepping in. Absolute phenomenal guy. And so you're like, I can see that you're hurting, son. Just confess. And even with this guy trying to heart-to-heart him, he straight tells them, like, I wish I could tell you what happened, but I was not there. I do not know. Sorry for this, family. So sorry. Do not know. So, and a side note on Mr. Highholt here, I believe his name was Kent, or Ken. He used to feed a precious cat, a homeless kitty, at his work. Like, he would bring tuna, and before he left, he would always make sure to feed this cat. He was a very loving, caring guy. He's described by his daughter as like a big teddy bear. He was like 6'5", big dude. Big dude. And these are some little fucking kids, like, at the time. They're 17 years old. They're not Chuck is little, Ryan's not. Ryan's very athletic. So Chuck is more scrawnier looking from the picture anyway. But Mr. Heichholz is a very big guy and a very sweet, kind man. And he's a sports writer there, and he would write about anybody's sport. He didn't care. He wasn't like, oh, let's just do football or whatever. He was like, nah, if you think your sport's important, I'll give you a little 150 words. So he's a really sweet guy. And his family did take in that precious little cat. I just want to say that. Because they felt if their dad loved that cat enough to feed that cat all the time, that they would need to take care of it now that their dad is gone. And at first, the daughter straight says, like, in her mind process. So there's two things. There's this documentary and the show 48 Hours, but you got to watch it on YouTube because it's very old. Anyway, so she says on the 48 Hours that, like, at first she didn't believe it because these were two young kids. And there's literally nothing tying these two to this crime. Literally nothing, except for Chuck's word. So when he goes to jail, when Ryan goes to jail, he's talking to his dad on the phone, and he's telling his dad, he's like, I need $60 bucks a week on commissary, and then I can get food, I can get stuff to eat, I'll be fine. And his dad says, is there anything else I can do? Now, anybody with a loved one in prison knows that is the most expensive goddamn place in the world. I swear it's probably more expensive than fucking college. Paying for someone in prison is ridiculous to make sure that they get enough to eat, to bathe, all that shit. For the soap, like Suave, dude, okay, on the street here, you can buy it 88 cents a bottle. Ben, you golden. In jail, they want me to pay as a person outside, or even an inmate who only makes maybe 50 cents an hour, to pay like $5.50. That is ridiculous. It is ridiculous the amount of money it takes to live while being in prison. It's dumb, my own opinion. Okay, so they go to the like bail hearing and him to say the not guilty and all that fun shit, and like they're like, okay, we'll set his bond, like get him his bond, because his dad, Bill, is willing to pay anything. He does not even believe that this is going on, because how he finds out is someone calls him, a family friend calls, and they're like, I heard Ryan got arrested. And he even says, nah, must be a different Ryan Ferguson, like it ain't mine, my baby boy don't do shit like this. And even the friend was like, you're probably right. Until there's a knock on his door, and it's two college reporters, and they're like, hey, want to make a statement? Because your son was just arrested. And he was like, fuck you guys, get off my porch. He didn't say that, but he was like, no, I don't. And so, horrible, right? To find out your precious baby boy, you have two children. And amazing children, okay? These are not children that give you a hard time. Not at all. It's super, I'm going to tell you guys some shit that, like, you just know that these two kids, if y'all ever met my kids, I want to replace them with some Kellys and some Ryans because they'd be nice. So his bail was set at $20 million. That is the highest bail ever set in the United States for one count of murder in the first degree. One count. One person. Ever. And here we have Lori Vallow, who killed children, and we're complaining about $1 million. And this fool had $20 million bond. 20 fucking million. Okay, so how the show goes, how it breaks it down, is it will give you his time incarcerated, how old he was, and then it fills in the gaps in between there. So that's what I did. I highlighted the time we talk about to him, the end. And so I don't have exact dates, a bunch of the stuff I tell you about, because the family doesn't give that. So anywho, okay, so 4 months in, he's 19 years old at this point in time. In December of 2004, his dad Bill got 11 boxes of his discovery, because Bill's gonna take on the fight to set his son free. So 18 months in county, okay, we haven't been to prison yet, we're just in county, he's 20 years old. October 17th, 2005, 4 years after the murder, Ryan's trial starts. They think it's going to be an open and closed case because literally there is nothing but Chuck saying he thinks he remembers, might have possibly could have been a dream, but he remembers Ryan was there. Ryan says he has no idea. We're going off of Chuck's word. And Chuck only knows the evidence that he knows because the fucking cops told him what he needs to know. Okay? I'm going to say that right now. Okay. So Kevin Crane is the Dick Ash prosecutor that we're going to talk about. So, he says the boys saw a man in the parking lot, okay, and that Chuck hits this man in the back of the head and he falls. When he falls, Ryan comes, strangles the man to death. Bam. And that the only witness he's going to, he tells everybody, I don't have no DNA, I don't have fingerprints, I don't have any of that shit. I have one fucking liar in a fat mouth named Chuck, who's a pathological liar named Chuck, who's going to come and testify and tell you guys what he is. Okay? So Ryan's the first one to go to court. And he is literally, his facial expression, and I see why the jury thought he was showing no emotion towards, like, the murder or whatever. But his face is literally like, why are we even fucking here? And he is showing that on his face. Like, his face is like, I don't need to be here. Like, I myself should not be here. And you can tell that he has this look of like, what the hell is going on his face? It's not a look like, oh, fuck this guy. Who cares? This guy died. It's a look of like, how did I end up sitting here? It's tragic. Absolutely tragic. So, Ryan goes on the stand. And Chuck goes on the stand. And he has come from not knowing anything really to being a top-notch testifier. Like, witness is what I mean. He like top notch. He remembers everything now. Now he knows incredible little details and everything else. So on the second anniversary, this fucking guy, Chuck, remembers everything. Well, it turns out now they're saying that Chuck is not the only dude who remembers this shit. Right. So Chuck says the only reason why he remembered, this is important, I guess I should say. The only reason why Chuck says he remembers is when he was reading this article, they were talking about how good of a man Mr. Highholt was and that he was a good man, all the things he accomplished, all those sweet things, and that's what triggered his mind as to being like, okay, it was me, it wasn't a dream. Okay, moving on. And he says he gets snapshots of that night. Like, what the fuck? He says he only gets like, he'll be like driving down the road and he'll look over and be like, why do I remember that spot so much? Oh, snapshot, this is why. Just fucking stupid. Like, just dumber than shit. Okay, so that's what he says. That he's just getting these snapshots of the night. And he's trying to, like, give full, lengthy, like, oh, man, you know, this is what it is. And it works as long as Mr. Crane is the one questioning him. It works. But, like, he's just redonkulous, this Chuck kid. Just redonkulous. Okay. So, then, there comes a guy who is a convicted child molester, but at the time, he is a fucking, what are they, janitor, maintenance. Yeah, maintenance guy at the newspaper office. So, he says, and this is what helps back this up, is when Chuck testifies, he says that he saw a lady yelling and saw a lady in a light in the door and yells, go get help. This man needs help. And the next thing he knew, Ryan's foot was on the guy's back. He was strangling him. Okay. And forget the other guy for a second. I'm going to tell you more about what Chuck said when he testified. So anyhow, so when he's testifying and he says that he put his foot, that Ryan put his foot on the back of this man, his foot on his back and strangles him. Okay, so for one, there should be what? Footprints on this man's back. Because according to him, he's already hit this man in the head with a tire iron. Hard as shit. Okay, he in the, even in the court, they like have him like show the force that he used. So hard as hell. And he says that this man goes down. So there should already be, and there's mad amount of blood everywhere. So there should already be blood everywhere. So if Ryan is walking up to him to do this, shouldn't he be stepping in blood to put blood on this man's back? So like there's that. That's also weird. That doesn't add up to the story. So that's weird. And so then Mr. Crane goes to him and says, if this was all a dream, why would you say this? And he says, this wasn't, Chuck says, I did this. He did this. I didn't dream anything. And so the jury is like, and then he says, Mr. Crane says, then why would you plead guilty? And Chuck says, because I am guilty, sir. I am 100% certain that me and Ryan Ferguson committed this crime. So obviously, we know that Chuck pled guilty because he got the deal. You don't get the deal unless you say you're guilty of the crime, obviously. And it's just, and Ryan's literally not showing anything. And so the jury's looking at him and they're looking at Chuck saying the story with so much passion and so much commitment. And then you look over at the table and you look at Ryan and Ryan's looking at him like, you are the dumbest fucking person I've ever met in my life. Like, and he looked, dude, I'm serious. This guy literally is sitting there in like a zombie looking face. Like, are we really in court right now for me? For murder? Cool. Like, I don't even know what the hell is going on. And so, it's just crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. And like I said, Chuck says he's 100% certain. That's like the final question. It's like, how certain are you? Now, Ryan's lawyer, he's a fucking joke. He is a legit joke. And his name is Mr. Rogers. He can't even remember who the hell he was talking to. At one point in time during these court proceedings, he even calls Chuck Mr. Ferguson. And Mr. Crane's like, that's Erickson, dumbass. So it was horrible. Horrible. And he would take like long ass pauses and he'd be like, and then Ryan's face, his eyeballs, dude, got huge because he was like, what are you doing, good sir? I'm going to go to prison for the rest of my life because you are incompetent. His dad, Bill, says it's, quote, painful to watch. It was painful to watch. This guy was just a complete fuck. He didn't even have the right map or the like right locations pinpointed on the map, even though Bill says, hey, I will do that for you. And he says, no, dude, I'm a lawyer. I got this. He should have let Bill do it because it would have been done right. So it was just shocking. Like, legitly shocking. And so Ryan is now deer in a headlights expression. Just big old eyes. We don't know what the hell's going on. And then all of a sudden, they're like, well, we're going to call Shauna to the stand. She's the girl that Chuck says he saw in the light. Dude, and she's about to cry literally from sitting down in the chair. She sits down and her lips are quivering. She wants to cry. She wants to get out of there. It's horrible. It's so sad. She does a composite sketch the day after the crimes committed of the two people she saw. And Ryan was 20 feet away from her, okay? 20 feet away, that's from you, probably your living room. You and someone from the doorway of your living room, probably to your couch, I'm going to assume, is about that distance. Not one time did Mr. Crane or Ryan's people ask this young woman if she could identify this man in court. Never once was she asked that question. Never one fucking time. Well, then, this is when, on day three of the courts, this is when the other guy comes in. Okay, so his name is Jerry Trump. He's the janitor. He says, when he's on the stand, that when he was in prison for being a child molester, that his wife sent him this news article, and he remembers it because that night at work, when he was working, two boys, he hears someone yelling, someone out there outside, and he yells, "Who's out there?" And two boys pop up from behind a car, and they say to this man, "Someone's hurt out here, man." And mind you, according to Chuck, he's already yelled to the girl in the doorway. So already the two other people are giving two different stories of how they heard and what they saw in the parking lot that night versus Chuck's story. Okay, stay with Chuck's story versus Chuck's story, because Ryan's story never wavers. It has always been, "I don't know, WTF." Okay, so he says when he's there, his wife mails him this. He opens it. He sees the picture. He does not see the headline of the article. He just sees the newspaper. When he looks at the newspaper, he says, "These are the two guys I know for sure are from the murder from that night. They are there." He says that he saw someone that was white, two men that were white between 19 and 20. And so he was 100, he didn't say 100%, but he just, like, the confidence in which he spoke gave him 100%. Now, Mr. Crane asked Mr. Trump, "Can you point this man out here in court today?" Mr. Trump says, "I sure can," and points at Ryan Ferguson and says, "That is the man." That was it. And everybody was like, "Well, damn, dude. Chuck remembers, this guy says that he looked at him in the eyeballs and eye-to-eyeballed him." And even, dude, Ryan's face will just make you cry the whole time. So everybody believes this guy. So Ryan himself is like, put me in the fucking game, coach. Put me in. Let me tell these people. And so that's unheard of. Mainly any case that you're ever in, especially when it's like a murder case, they don't ever want the accused to testify, because then I put you in a spot where you can, if you are lying, I mean, you can fuck yourself. So he says he wants to go on the stand. Well, in your mind's right, you think, perfect, right? This is going to be the way I'm going to get away with it. But you are not thinking what these 12 other people have already heard. So he shows no remorse. And he even does this cute little smirk. I wouldn't say it's a laugh. It's more of like a nervous chuckle of like, "I can't believe you just said that in court." Because Mr. Crane says, "You even said that Chuck was a little odd, right?" And then Ryan smirks and kind of chuckles. And he goes, "Yeah, he's a little odd." And then he's like, whoa, was that fucking funny, motherfucker? And he starts questioning about that. And Ryan's like, "Well, no, it's not funny." But you can tell that he's just nervous. And he was not prepped at all to go on the stand. He has no idea how to handle himself. No one told him, present yourself remorseful for this man, but still stand your ground on the fact that you did not do anything. Do not go up there and stone face it. And that's what he did. He went up there and stone faced it. And the only sort of expression he chose to do, may it be intentional or unintentional, was that whole little, "Is Chuck odd?" He smirks, kind of laughs. And so that's what they saw, right? So obviously the jury's like, "This dude's a fucking dick." So Ryan says, quote, "I never thought I'd be arrested for a crime I didn't commit. Would you? Would you believe you'd be arrested for a crime you didn't commit?" Mr. Crane says, "I didn't commit one." Ryan comes back strong and firm, "Neither did I. And his whole family uproars, dude. And there's like, ah! Clapping. There's like, fuck yeah! No one says that, but like, in their heart of hearts, I know that's what they were doing. Like, literally, mic drop. And right there, if I was a juror, right there in that point in time, I would have been like, well, maybe this kid is fucking on to something. And, like, they did show video clips and all that shit from the interrogations, but the audio and the video were so fucking horrible that the jury couldn't see nor really truly hear what was being played for them. So, I just feel like they didn't take that all into consideration like they should have. So, day five, court ends, okay? The jury goes, and 5.5 hours later, they come back with a guilty for murder of in the second degree for Ryan, and guilty of robbery in the first. Watching his family hear that was truly heartbreaking. You could see on their faces that they were like, okay, any second now, this is all going to be over. We're going to get Ryan. We're going to go home. We're going to be fine. Everything's going to be done. This will all just be a laughable mistake at one point in time. But no, that's not what happened. The family was truly devastated and truly heartbreaking. If you've ever, ever known anybody to go to jail. Okay, so my little brother started being a little shit when he was about 11, give or take. And here, when you get committed to the state of Idaho, at least in my brother's situation, you go to St. Anthony. But when you get committed, they take away your parental rights. Obviously, he's not my child, so that wasn't that devastating to me. But they take him. He's no longer in the same town as you. He's gone. And it's very hard. Up until the point where when they're first in jail, you always have that hope that, oh, okay, this whole thing, this whole wrong will be written right and everything will be better. But when you go to the court and they tell you you're guilty and you hear that guilty and they're like, oh, now we're going to start talking sentencing. Your heart's in a panic, you're devastated, you're frightened, you're scared, you don't really understand. Did you really just hear the word you thought you hear? What does that mean? Guilty means what? And in my situation, I'm 13 months older than my twin siblings. So he was 11, I'm going to say I was 12, maybe going on 13, so he was maybe going on 12, maybe, I don't know. But, dude, in my ears, I heard, you just lost your brother forever and always. Now he's not your brother. Now he's a fucking ward of the state. And he's not going to be in the same town as you. Now it's going to be a whole drive. It's going to be a commitment to go see him. You can't hug him. You can't talk to him like you used to talk to him. Now he can't call me like he used to call me. A whole bunch of shit changes when someone gets sentenced. And they put you in that position right then and there where Ryan's family had to go on the stand and plead their case to how amazing Ryan is and that they are truly baffled and dumbfounded by what just occurred. And so they put Bill on the stand and he is just amazing. This literally, if you commit a crime and you don't commit a crime and like your family doesn't believe you, for shame, you will always sit there and say to yourself, I wish I had Bill Ferguson as a father, because this man is amazing. Bill says, quote, I am truly convinced that he is innocent. I'm going to learn more and I'm going to prove my son innocence, and so will my family. And he says, I was there when he was born. I was right there. And if he goes to jail the time that we're talking, I'm never going to see my son again. And it's just, I can't, dude, it's just so hard. And especially, and I hate it, because then you read comments, and I hate reading the comments on stuff. Because then people are like, well, he's being dramatic. He was being way dramatic by saying he was never going to see him again. this man lost his life. He only cares that he's not going to be able to see his son, but he can. He can go to visits. But like I said before, seeing him is different. You get to see them, yes, but you don't get to touch them. Fuck, half the time you don't even get close enough to get the smell of them, to remember their smell. So there's a difference between seeing him and seeing him. Like, it's just a huge difference, and it's just so sad that you know, and you have to sit in these court proceedings, especially for the innocent. I'm really not talking about the guilty here, people. I'm really not. To sit there and watch these people that love you and care about you plead for you, and you can't hug them, you can't tell them, oh, dude, dad, I know. Thank you for saying everything. I got this, though. I'm going to stone. At that point in time, you can't. And it's so hard, and it just breaks your heart because you just want to cry. And, like, Ryan is already in I have to be tough mode guy. So he's crying, but it's a subtle little, like, wipe away of his tears. And in that situation, you should have the right to be dramatic, bro. And throw a fucking fit. You're not guilty. And your dad's pleading for your life. When that is wrong. And you know it's wrong. I mean, granted, these 12 people think that they just put away the worst 17-year-old, 18-year-old that they could ever put away. But they didn't. You put away a guilty man. And really, when it comes down to it, and you say all you believe is Chuck and this other man, and this woman who was not even asked to point it right out in court, I just don't know how 12 people come to that conclusion. I don't know how 12 people, there was not one person in that room that said, guys, none of this sounds fishy to anyone in here. No, they go off of, why would someone say that he committed a crime? Why would someone say he's guilty? And Chuck fucked this up for everybody across the board. For Ryan and himself. Completely fucked them up. It's just, we'll get to it. It's so horrible. But they later on in the documentary, Bill does say that he doesn't even remember what he said when he was talking to the jury. That he was literally in, like, a fog, and that it all just came from the heart, and that it was as true as it came out. So the jury gave Ryan 30 years for the murder and 10 years for the robbery, so a total of 40. You hear his sweet sister Kelly yell. Well, she doesn't like yell, but she yells. She says, quote, "We love you. Oh, love you. We'll get you out," end quote. And right after court, right when they walk out the doors, this family has cameras in their face. And they're like, well, tell us how you feel. Tell us how you feel. What does it feel like? Because they walked in there with confidence before. And they talked to the press before. And they were like, oh, no, I think we're good. And so now they're like, well, what do you feel? How do you feel? Ha, ha, ha. You know, trying to rub it in their face. And Bill talks to them. And Bill says, well, in the words of John Paul Jones, we have just began to fight. So, here's a cute little story that I had to tell you guys because I told you in the documentary, and I think it'd be just rude of me if I didn't mention it. So, here's a cute little love story. So, his parents met at the University of Missouri in 1972. They finished school. They get married. They decide, we're going to travel overseas. We're going to take some time. We're going to travel. They bought a vehicle in Amsterdam. They drove it all the way to the Arctic Circle where the engine seized. And so when the engine seizes, obviously now they need money because they're way over budget. And they have to figure out how to get money so they can continue on. So Bill starts welding, even though he's not a welder. He just tells everybody he is. And he was in the, I believe it was the Army. And so he was just pretty much like, I can do anything I put my heart to. I got this. And then they go to Africa. they go to spend some time in Africa, and then they go to Australia. Their daughter Kelly was born at Docker River in Australia, and then they moved to the northern part of Australia where Ryan was born. They only planned this trip for 2 years, but 10 years and two kids later, they came back home to Colombia, and it was just an amazing, like, you go through all of that. You have all of that history. Just, it's so sad. It's just so sad. His mom says that Ryan was an easy kid to raise. He was very loving. He was a very curious child. He was very fit. He never got sick of hanging out with his parents. He always wanted to hang out with his parents, hug his parents. He was never afraid to show his love and affection for his family. Now, they did split up before Ryan's arrest, but his arrest kind of brought them back together as parents, not as a couple, but as parents. The day after court, the shock was still kind of wearing off, but then Bill says that's when he knew the fight had to start. He went to the crime scene. He walked that crime scene. He walked around 3 or 4 blocks of that crime scene almost every night. He would go mainly when the moon was full because it was full on the night of the murder. He liked it when it was about 65 degrees because that's how it was that night too. And he would. He would just hang out for an hour. I mean, not for longer. He would go there about midnight or 1, the crime scene. And he would stay till about 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning. He said it was just him and some stray cats that were just kicking it out there. And finally, a reporter that wrote a really shoddy story on Ryan, he told that reporter, he said, you know what? Bring you and your fucking know-it-all mind. Come down to this crime scene. Walk it with me. Let me show you how you're wrong. And so he did. And that night started it off, man. That when he did that first tour, that started it off. And he was like, you know what? Everybody should know. So he started doing tours. And he would show anybody. He would take anybody. He said he would do them from 10 people to 1 person. That the school, the local junior high there, even brought 2 busloads of kids to come and walk this crime scene with him and know it. And so Ryan describes his jail cell. And so I'm going to tell you the way Ryan says it. He says, go into your bathroom, a 10 by 10. Take out your bathtub, put in a bunk bed. And then you have your sink and your toilet all together, all connected, and a desk with a stool. That's his room. And he says, you hear the lock at night, you hear the locking of the doors because it's loud and they slam. You hear the buzzing of the light that's been on all day, the screaming, the yelling, the pounding on the walls, the keys from the guards jingling. You hear the screams of people being beaten and raped. You hear the sounds of shoes squeaking on the floor above you. You hear that man being beaten or raped, yelling for help, yelling for someone to help him. But you have to lay in your bed knowing all the while that not one person in that dorm is going to get up and push the button to help that man, to bring a CO in. There's no way that they will do that for you. And so, imagine, and prison is scary. Okay, and Ryan even says those, like, he even says that those sounds don't happen every night, but those are the sounds that play in your head every night. And my brother is probably the definition of institutionalized, I want to say. Like I said, he tries to do well every time he gets out. I mean, he always comes out with the intent to do well. It just never plays off that way. But if you've ever known someone, my brother, when he was first committed, when he came home, it was weird. For us, it was like, oh my God, you're back to normal. Everything's normal. But for him, he just went from being locked up and then to a halfway house before he could come home. So to us, it's like, dude, just go back to the way you, just go back. Like, go in your room. It's your room. Lay on your bed. Fucking your clothes, your stuff. But he wasn't that way for a while. When he first came home, when he went to the bathroom, he would take his bucket. He kept his own toilet paper. Like, that type of stuff, it, even now, and right now, he's sitting in jail for a supposed crime he could have or could not have committed. It's a whole fucking thing. It's a whole domestic abuse methamphetamine situation. So it's a whole crazy situation. But I don't know, man. Like, I can't even imagine, especially being there when you're not meant to be there and you've tried. And Ryan did. He tried his hardest to be the person that would never be there, to be a person his parents could be proud of, to be an amazing athlete. He was an athlete. He was a good kid. He did his chores. He loved his parents. He knew to go to college he would need a scholarship, so he needed to be good at something. Like, you know what I mean? This man made the path, made the roadmap to where he would never be the person who had to hear these sounds or hear these things or know the things he knows, and now he is wrongfully being forced to hear these sounds and to know these things and to know the evil behind the walls of a prison. We think out here in society, they go to prison, that's fine. Whatever happens to them in there is fine. They deserve it. They committed a crime. But we also need to keep in mind that some of these men are put in there for drugs. And they are being put in there with rapists and killers. Those are not the two same men. Your mentality is different. The way you think is different. The way you act and the way you punish people for their crimes, whether it be raping them and or beating them, it's different. You have two different mindsets. And so to put someone who's completely innocent, that does not know the background it takes to survive in prison, being told, hey fucker dude, today's your first day, figure it out, solve it now, astounds me. That right there, people need to realize, you don't go to prison to go to Walt Disney World. You go to prison because you've done a crime. You've committed a crime. You have a history of committing a fucking crime. You have knowings of the underground darkness in the world, shadiness of the world. And so when you go there, the streets don't change. The rules are more serious, but the rules are still the same. They still come down to the same things. You fucking respect who's in charge. You follow in line, you do what you're supposed to fucking do, you mind your business. It just blows. Okay, sorry, that was a long tangent. I can't even imagine. So, Bill, right, he starts up a webpage and everything else because he cannot stand the fact that his poor son is in there listening to these things, knowing these things. And so he starts up the website, and he says when he starts this up, he knows if he gets enough people talking that eventually the people who do know the right things will come forward and say so. So finally he gets someone on there that says that they need to talk to him, that they have info they would like to share, and they found out it's Shauna. So the girl from court who drew the two composite sketches. So he says, how about you meet me at the parking lot where it happened? Bring your family, bring your friends, bring whoever you want to bring. You don't need to feel uncomfortable. There's no need for that. And this is his first time questioning someone. So he's like, I'm nervous, I'm excited, I got this. And so when Bill gets there and they're doing this, of course, the number one question on Bill's mind is, I just want to ask her if it was fucking Ryan. Like, I just want to ask her. But he doesn't. He eases into it. But it does come up. And she says, no, he wasn't the man. She says, if anything, Chuck looked more like the guy. But it wasn't Chuck either. She said that she told Mr. Crane this, that she was 100% sure, confident, knew for a fact that these two men are not the ones that did it. And Mr. Crane said that one of them already confessed, so pretty much it doesn't fucking matter. And that, and he's told her, like, why would he commit, why would he say if he didn't do it? And she said, people do it all the time. And, like, she stuck to that, that this was not the person she saw, was not the person. And so, it just was absolute horrible. She says that Mr. Crane is an asshole, that he made her feel like she was the one that was in trouble and she was scared to death, and that she was only going to answer the questions that were asked of her. She was not going to say anything else in fear that something may or may not happen to her. She was not 100% sure. And so, she said that she told everyone and anyone that would listen to her that Ryan and Chuck were not the people who did this. They were not the people. And so, Bill, right then and there, he was like, you know what? Fucking game on, dude. Let's do this. I'm going to save my boy. I'm going to save him. But he knew he would need way more than that to save Ryan. That he was going to need way more. He called it the end of the wedge, that it was the end of the wedge. And what a wedge is when you're chopping down trees, you put a wedge in there and you smack it with a hammer, a sledgehammer, and it helps knock the tree down. So you put it down at the base, okay? So that you put it at the base, you whack it, it splits the tree falls. So he says that she is the end of the wedge. Now, we go to 3 years in prison, and he's now 22-year-old. Bill, ow, sorry, I just like hit myself. Bill talks about how they would always play basketball together, and that they were more than just son and father. They were best friends. They did everything together. I mean, it started out little shit when Ryan was little, but it progressed into fucking skydiving and just like, this is my pal, this is my buddy, this is the guy I'm gonna do everything with. And one precious little story he tells is him and Ryan used to play ball together. And they were at the park one day, and they see these two guys playing ball. And so they go up and they ask him, like, hey, can we play ball with you guys? And they were like, well, who gets the little kid? And Bill says, oh, I'll get him. And Ryan's like, Dad, we're going to lose. And he says, you know what? These guys are going to go, and they're going to try to block you. They're going to try to block me. I'm the big guy. They're not going to think to block you. And they go and they win this, right? I probably just fucked up that cute little story. But the moral of the story is, like, they beat these two older guys. And it was a father-son victory. It was super cute. And that they played ball once a week all the way up until right before Ryan was arrested. And then that's, like, the memory he wants to, like, obviously get back. And, like, that's one of the things he misses the most. And Ryan then says that the first time he went to the yard, he was scared shitless. He's a little white guy. He doesn't know the rules of the land and all that stuff. And so he starts playing ball. And mind you, these dudes in prison, they're only playing ball to pass the time. He's played ball as, like, I can play ball. Like, I can shoot, I can dunk it, I got this. I can dribble, I can run and dribble. Like, I got skills that you don't got. And so he did. He played these guys, and it got him enough respect that people didn't fuck with him. They probably still fucked with him, but they didn't test him. It wasn't a test to see, can this guy hold his own or can he not? Because in prison, we're not too touching in a game of ball. It's not like, oh, you fouled. No, I'm going to fucking shoulder shock you, bro. I'm going to chin check you real quick, and it'll all be all right. So that's the kind of ball he went from playing nice ball with his daddy to not so nice ball. Okay. So then it goes to 4 years and 4 years in prison, and he's now 23 years old. And Bill is sitting there, and he's like, you know what? I need to find the guy that they say that they saw at the intersection, right? So this guy's name is Dallas. Chuck says that they see him that night. He's sitting at the intersection, the flashing yellow light, and it's like a light bulb goes off in his head. He says that night that Chuck, that they saw each other, if that light was flashing, the light at the intersection, if that light was flashing at 1 a.m. that morning, where Bill was sitting, then it had to have been flashing the night of the murder at 2:15 in the morning. And so there's no way in hell that they saw Dallas and had a conversation with him, because you would not have stopped at that intersection. It's like, why would you have stopped? If you're not being made to stop, you're not going to completely stop. Especially at 2 o'clock in the morning. You're just not going to. And one of the things Chuck says is he thinks that they did this for drinking money. And he even says that the first court appearance, that when they walked away from killing him to go back to the bar at like 2:30 in the morning, that Ryan had pulled $20 out of his wallet or something that he had forgotten that was in there. And he made the comment of like, oh, we did that all for nothing. Like, that's how much Chuck dug into this and like put into the roots of, no, we did do it. Like, that's how much. That's how his story was so convincing. So 5 years in prison at 24 years old. In 08, he had an evidentiary hearing, which he was given a public defender. And they brought in 11 people that could have been put into the first court to testify, including the guy, Dallas himself. He said he didn't even see them that night and that he wasn't driving. And he said the cops bullied him into saying whatever they wanted him to say so that he could go home. And that he said, and he does say, on second thought, maybe he did see him. Maybe he did see Chuck. Maybe he did talk to them. And when the public defender is like, well, tell us, how are you sure that you did not talk to them that night and you were not seen and you weren't driving? And he's like, well, for one, I didn't have a license or a vehicle at the time. And for two, I had a DWI. So, no, yo shit. So there's no possible way. And he was never even called to testify in the first court hearing anyway. And even Shauna got up there and told her a story about how she felt intimidated, that it wasn't them. And then this judge just drives me nuts. So a side note. When they break in the documentary from the court, Ryan teaches you how to make prison pizza. And if anybody's ever had ramen burrito from anybody who's ever been in prison, bon appetito. Delicious. Okay. So every 4 months, he gets a food visit. And so his mom, he used to like fresh fruit. Well, he doesn't like to use, he liked fresh fruit. So she would bring him just a bowl of fresh fruit. And he would smell it and ooh and ah over the colors and everything else. It takes her 3 days to prepare for a food visit because she's such a good mom. And she even tells a cute little story of like how a mama just loves her baby. She'll do anything to make her baby happy. Well, what happened was they said no more fresh fruits, right? So she still decides that she's going to sneak in a fresh peach underneath some spinach. And she tells a story about how they put him at like a visiting table right next to the guard stand, and that they were super scared that she would have to throw the peach away and he wouldn't be able to eat it. And then at the last minute, they switched his visiting table to a table in the back. And so he got to eat that fresh peach, but then she like kind of kicked herself in the butt that she didn't cut up more. So it was just a cute little story. Absolutely cute. Okay, so now, Ryan's story is being featured on 48 Hours, and stuff like that. So Ryan's talking to this girl. She tells him about this amazing woman, Kathleen Zellner. She is truly the baddest bitch on the planet. And I say the baddest bitch out of the most up respect as I could possibly give this woman. The most up respect. Literally bad to the bone. She's helping our Making a Murderer boys rat meow too, just so you know. Anywho, so she's amazing. Baddest bitch on the planet. Baddest. Well, little did they know. So they know, they want her, right? Bill's like, Ryan tells Bill, and Bill's like, we gotta get her. We have to get her. So Bill reaches out to her and writes her an email. Little does he know that she's also watching his thing on TV, and she tells her husband, if this family ever reaches out to me, I'm gonna take on this shit pro bono, because she watches Ryan's court and everything else, and she's like, this dude just wasn't prepped properly, and this guy fucking sucked, this lawyer sucked, so I'll do this shit pro bono. Well, Bill writes her an email in the middle of the night, and he's like, this will be forever and a day before I even hear anything back from her. And she writes him back by noon the next day. And he says, come down here, come meet Ryan, come walk the crime scene with me, and you'll see why I believe my son is innocent. She came and saw Ryan and walked that crime scene and everything else within 2 weeks of meeting him, of talking to him on the phone. She is literally, truly bad to the fucking bone. Literally and truly. Just amazing, 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 amazing. If you didn't do it, like, you are literally innocent, and you have tried everything you can possibly try, y'all need to get Kathleen, because you'll be getting out. She don't fuck around. She don't play. So, Ryan also tells how it is to want to show your emotion and not be able to show your emotion. And he says one of the story that he uses is, you want to cry, right? You want to break down and you want to cry, especially when you're not meant to be there. And he's got his TV, and this big guy has his TV, and they're watching The Notebook, I think it is. And that guy ends up crying, right? And he's sitting there, and he's like, I can't even talk to this dude, because I know if I talk to this guy, I'm going to cry, and I don't want to cry in front of this big guy. And that he just loves romantic movies and stuff like that, because it's a way to bring out his emotional side that, for whatever reason, is on lockdown, unless it comes to that. So it's just super amazing. It was super nice to hear how he got through it, and just all the environmental changes. You know, you go from being able to cry wherever you want to being afraid to cry because you don't know what crying will lead to if anybody else sees you cry. And it was super sad. Kathleen does say in that part that she believes a part of Bill died and that he will not be okay until Ryan is out. And that's just super sad. So now we are 6 years in at 25 years old. Now, Chuck sends a letter to Ryan for the first time ever, telling him, hey, the next time your attorney's in town, have her get a hold of me. And so they do, and Kathleen freaks out. She's like, I need to get down there. I need to videotape this motherfucker. We're going to do a sworn testimony, a sworn thingy. We're going to make him do the whole raise your hand, praise to Jesus, the whole thing. And he says, and she's expecting him to be like, hey, everything's Ryan's fault. Whatever, you're wasting your time. That's not what happens. He says that he is the one who did everything. That he is responsible by himself. And that he didn't want to go on with the lies. And that he couldn't live with himself. Knowing that Ryan was going to keep getting punished. And this whole time, Kathleen is like, Bro, I know you didn't do this either. Like, I know both of you are innocent as fuck. And so it was just super, super, super sad. Because, like, he's trying to make his wrongs right. And now is when we're going to start calling him Charles. Because at the beginning of this, she asks him, do you want to be called Chuck, Mr. Erickson, or Charles, whatever. He says either Mr. Erickson or Charles because he is no longer Chuck. And when you don't want to be called by your nickname, it shows improvement, it shows growth, and it shows that he is no longer the punk-ass little kid he was before. So, we will now call him Charles. And so, like I said, he knew that she knew that they both are innocent and that they didn't do anything at all. So, when Bill's watching the court tape for the 10th millionth time, it clicks in his head, nobody asked Mrs. Trump why she sent the news clipping. Why did she even send that? Like, what was her reasoning behind the letter to begin with? And so he goes and talks to her, and she straight says, like, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no clue. And it was just super heartbreaking because, like, he doesn't tell her that it's right, like, Ryan's his son until the end. She's like, wait, what did you say your name was? And then she, like, clicks the dots, and she's like, I don't even know if I should be talking to you. And he's like, it's all right, you don't have to, but you did. And I'm just going to leave. Like, I'm not going to harass you. I'm just going to go. I got what I needed to know, and I'm going to go. So then it goes to 8 years in prison. He is now 27 years old. There are 7 unidentified prints from the scene of the crime that nobody can match to either one of these two boys. Kathleen says it's harder to get the wrongful things undone, even though you should just be able to go and give the state the evidence and the proof that the crime isn't what happened. And it should be that easy. You should be able to go and say, this is why he is innocent, this is why it was a wrongful conviction, go ahead, fix it, I'll go pick him up when we're done talking about it, thanks for the cooperation. That's not what happens, obviously. So, she is just baffled, absolutely baffled. And she says that even the old lawyer that was from the previous court cases, because mind you, Ryan's had 2 previous representatives by this point in time, that they just she didn't say this, but it's what I took from it. They just don't have she's not afraid. There we go. They didn't have the cojones, the balls to do so, such a task on fighting for this man's innocence, really. And Charles said that he was lied to and he was tricked, and she starts sending him everything. She starts sending him all of the real witness statements, and she just starts sending him everything from Ryan's file to Charles. So he's seeing the real paperwork of what Ryan has. And so he is now just getting mind-fucked is what he's doing. So he was tricked, and obviously. And so now Ryan goes back in front of the courts again for a post-conviction hearing. This time, Charles goes and testifies again, but he testifies the fact that he was tricked and that he lied about everything to save himself. And even the prosecutor, who's a different prosecutor, says that your deal is still in place. Why would you come forward now knowing that you could spend the rest of your life in prison? And he just simply, dude, he's like starts to cry and that he just didn't want to lie. Like, he cannot lie. And it was just so horrible, dude, to believe that we live in a world where you can go get blacked out drunk, go commit a crime, think you possibly maybe could have sort of did it. You've had dreams about a horrible incident happening. And then you go tell the cops all this shit. And they're like, oh, okay, well, now we have someone to blame. The only unsolved murder we've had. Let's take this kid at his word and let's just fuck up their lives. And it doesn't matter that he doesn't know anything about the crime or where in the parking lot it happened or what the guy was even killed with. All that matters is he is saying that he did it and he knows about it. So, bam. And that's fucked up. That's why Charles was trying to do the right thing. He even almost cries on the stand and he says he doesn't want to die knowing he did the wrong thing. And even in this hearing, dude, even Jerry Trump himself comes back on the stand and says that he was lying and that it was made up, that Mr. Crane came up with the story, that his wife never sent him the paper, and that he was a newfound Mormon, maybe, praise Jesus, and he wanted to make it right. And that the only thing that he wanted to come out of that was for Ryan's forgiveness, and that Mr. Crane scared him and he was intimidated. And it was just, they switch over to Ryan's face and you can tell that he was on fire, that his blood must have just been a million degrees, dude, because, like, I would want to fucking strangle you. Your wife put me in prison, bro. I've been in prison for 8 fucking years. 8 years. And now you want me to forgive you? He does. He's such a good guy. And even Ryan says it does take a lot of respect to get up on the stand and to say what you knew to be wrong is wrong. And then Judge Crane testifies as well at this hearing. And the new judge on this hearing, Judge Green, pretty much gets on his knees and asks Mr. Crane, does he like it soft or hard towards the tip? Like, he dick sucking him all the way, okay? It was horrible. And he's like, do you want to be called a judge? Even though at the time of this, you were not a judge, but you are a judge. And ooh, judge, judge, judge. And then he straight tells everybody. He's like, I'm going to tell all of you guys to refer to him as Judge Crane. Fucking eat me is what I would have said. Anyway, he gets up there and he goes, of course I didn't lie. I didn't make up anything. I didn't have anybody lie. I didn't ask anybody to lie. I am a judge. And the whole time, Ryan's giving him that look like, fuck you, bitch, explain it. Because Kathleen Zoller don't play. She puts him on the spot in some hard situations that he really is just like, oh, well. And he even says a couple of times, well, whatever the record reflects is what we'll go off of. And that's just code for I am wrong and I am a lying piece of shit. But I don't want to say it because I can't say it because then I'll lose my job. Is what it comes down to. And so you would think that hearing all of these things that Judge Green would go and be like, okay, cool, yeah. And everybody thought this was it. This was over. This was all going to be done. All the witnesses took back all their testimonies. This is the first time ever where both witnesses take back their testimony and nothing is done on that. This man is literally, truly, at this point in time, sitting in prison based off of lies, and that is it. That is the only thing putting him in prison, is the word of others. And Ryan always knew that he would get out one day. But 6 months after that hearing, the judge comes back and says, fuck no. Ain't happening. Everybody has a reason to lie. Those people are all lying. Mr. Judge Crane did a great job. He won his case. Even Kathleen said that she wanted to call him and tell him that you are a disgrace to the profession. And then she said, you know what? No, I'm going to take this and I'm going to tear it apart. And she says, and this is why I say that she is one of the baddest bitches in the world. And she says that she was going to take his ruling, and she was going to show the world that he was incompetent. Bam! He even gave his judgment on the anniversary of the death of the murder, so everybody was kind of like, well, that didn't really need to happen. You didn't need to wait it out for that long. And everybody is in shock. Everyone is in shock. But they have a backup plan. Because like Bill says, you need a backup plan to your backup plan to your backup plan. So they got a billboard with the composite sketches that Shauna drew and asking for people for help. And this way they knew that they were telling everyone, we are not going to stop fighting. We will continue to fight. I will prove his innocence is what was being done. And then they started using the media, and they started growing and growing and growing. And then all of a sudden, everywhere, people around the world were posting pictures with signs saying, free Ryan Ferguson now, free Ryan, freeryanferguson.com. So the next phase that they went on to, the next court that they went to, was the Western District Court in Kansas City. And Bill said that he had already been looking into how to get his case in front of the World Court if the courts that they were, the Western Court, didn't prevail, that they were going to go to the World Court. And in the court that they were going into, Kathleen only has 15 minutes to plead her case. And you don't ever know what piece of paper in your filing they're going to use to talk to you about. So you have to know all of your shit. Everything. Everything you've ever known about this case. This is the day you have to know it, and you cannot forget. This is not a day. This is the day that you put 3 years of your hard work into 160 papers. Give it to them and you show your skill. And your skill is what you rely on at that point in time. Thank God she has the best. And poor Ryan was left alone to freak out in his cell because his cellmate had work that day. So he was just freaking out, knowing that in a whole other place that people are fighting for you and you are not there. But you are still being fought for. You don't know what's happening. You don't know what's being said. Ugh, the panic I couldn't even handle. So, when you bring up a Brady violation, when you bring up those things, you have to show that everything that you're saying is a lie is a lie. That there is nothing that can be used against you to show otherwise. So when Mr. Crane says that Mr. Trump came to him, willingly gave him this information, is a lie. Because Mr. Trump says that is not what happened, that Mr. Crane gave him the story, Mr. Crane made it up, he did not willingly give them anything, it was a deal, he was getting a deal for giving his testimony. And so there was just Brady violations all over this case, everywhere, okay, from telling him pretty much how the crime happened, giving him all of that information, all of it. Mr. Crane was just dirty from the beginning. From the beginning. Just dirty, dirty, dirty. And Ryan says this whole time, like, if he ever gets out, if he does get out, then he really just wants to take care of his parents, and that he will take care of his parents till their last breath, and that they did it for him, and so that he would do it for them. And it was just amazing. And so Bill got a car with freeryanferguson.com, wrongfully convicted, time for justice, free Ryan, blasted all over this fucking thing. Well, when the court ends, that's what he gets to drive around, and he drives it all around Washington, D.C. He goes to monuments, he's handing out cards to people, he's trying to get the word out there. And so on, I don't have the exact date. 9.5 years in prison, and at 29 years old, 2 months after that hearing, November 5th, they were told that Ryan was coming home, not going to another court, not maybe possibly going to get vacated, nothing. It was your son's getting out today, go pick up your fucking kid today, right now, go do it. It was just so, he hugged his mama first and then his dad, and like I just sat there and bawled and cried. And Kathleen Zellner says that there are 20 million people locked up in the United States and 2 million people locked up in the world, and 20,000 of them are innocent. And she says that normally it's as easy as, like I said, presenting the case, everything's done and it goes. And she says, quote, "This is a real disturbing at every level for Ryan's case. It was just completely devastating. She's never seen so many people try to protect the wrongdoing of a conviction ever. And that usually when prosecutors in the state finds out they're wrong, they quickly go to fix that because they realize that prison is not the place for innocent people." 5 months after his release, Ryan says, quote, "I can't find peace. At some moments in prison, he had more peace than he does now." And what that, and he says, being institutionalized, that must be what being institutionalized feels like. He spent his whole 20s in prison. He gets out at 30 years old. And my brother is literally institutionalized. And so what he means when he says that is like he can't find peace, and he found more peace at times in prison than he does on the street. Is when you're in prison, that's all you have, is you're in prison. You're aware. I'm not leaving. Tomorrow morning, they're going to count. They're going to count in the afternoon. We're going to have dinner. And you get into that routine. Okay, every day. Every day. For, what was it, 9.5 years? That's what you do. You wake up. You read a book. You work out. You do this. You do that. Repeat. Repeat. 9.5 years. And then you're told, dude, you're going to have dinner at your mom's house today, bud. Go. How do you live with that? How do you separate that? Because now you're just being thrown, and like your family and everybody, like I said, we did it to my brother. We are just like, oh, you're out. Everything's normal. Go. No, in 9.5 years, you missed a lot. I mean, good fuck. You missed smartphones. Like, people are handing you a phone that you don't know how to use. Driving's changed. Cigarettes have changed. They don't even taste the same. Everything is different, and you're getting put into this world where all of a sudden now people are expecting more of you than you've had to give out of yourself in the last 9.5 years. Now you want to find a job. You need to find a job. Do you go back to school? Do you not go back to school? And there's still people that are going to believe that you're a murderer, even though you've pleaded your case. Your family's fought for you for 9.5 years. They've given everybody every little piece of information they need to know that you are innocent. There's still going to be people in the world that don't believe that. And it doesn't get easy. Just because you're released does not wipe away the 9.5 years of bullshit and the feelings and the just, I don't even know. It's like fucking PTSD, for real. Like, okay, so when my dad went to prison, he spent 13 years, I want to say, 13 years. You don't even drive a car. I mean, and before, he drove us everywhere. He had to relearn to drive. Like, all those little things. Shopping's different. You no longer swipe a credit card. Oh, no, 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 no. Now you insert it into the machine. Now it beeps at you. Oh, you forgot your card? It doesn't even matter, bro. You don't have that app on your phone that acts as a card. You can just tap the little screen. Go on. Like, when you are locked up, the world doesn't go with you. It stops. You go back in there to the remote, the clicky, the channels. That's all you got. You don't have a way to get information right here, right now. You don't have a phone. You don't, you know, It's just so much harder. And when they do this to people and they release you and they put you out into the world and they say, okay, well, now go do a press conference, go thank everyone, and then go on, dude, go be normal. We let you out. We did our justice. That's not justice. If anything, you're hurting them even more, because that whole 9.5 years, you never for a second gave this man any skills that he would need on the outside, because you were so stuck in your way that this man will rot away in prison, that you did not give him any skills. You did not teach him people-to-people conversations or how to interact with people. He knows how to interact with a bunch of dudes and a bunch of fucking inmates, sure, but he doesn't know how to interact with a bunch of people at the line at the Walmart, you know what I mean? Like, it's two different things. Like, we wanted to surround my brother with family and everything else, and that just put him into a panic, and we don't get it, right? The first time, like, mind you, now, obviously, I'm very, very, very well equipped with people incarcerations. But the first time, we don't understand. We just want to show them that we love them, we miss them, we want to shower them with everything and anything, but we can't. Like, it's just going to put your loved one in a panic and a frenzy, and that's just going to put them into a situation where they're not safe. My brother still to this very day, even though he's in jail right now, can probably eat his meal in under 2.5 seconds. And that's, you want to eat your shit and you want to get the fuck out of wherever you are. You want to eat so no one else can eat your shit and no one can fuck with you and you can get gone. Little stuff like that. It's just, it all adds up. So the end show notes at the end of the show say that Ryan moved to Florida to start a new life. Like I said, Ryan, bro, if you hear this, how are you? I hope you are good. I really, really do. Bill continued to work on the wrongfully convicted, and he says, and he's even trying to help Charles get out. And Charles, they call him Chuck, but Charles Erickson is up for parole in 2020, so the best of luck to you. Hopefully you get your day as a free man as well. And Kevin Crane is now a circuit court judge in Missouri, so I fear for anyone who has to go in front of him in Missouri, because this motherfucker is just corrupt and doesn't give two shits about right or wrong. And the murder is now unsolved and remains unsolved. And on June 10th, 2017, Ryan was awarded $11 million in a civil judgment, and that is $1 million for every year that he lost in prison, and that is not even enough. And he needs 10 times that amount, because we let him sit there and we let him rot and we didn't do anything when he said he didn't do anything. And now, like my, okay, so I've had someone ask me how I do this, and I can sit there and criticize my brother so much. Well, the best way I can describe this is the little boy who called Wolf. Okay, and everybody hears this story differently. So the story I've always heard is there's this little boy who really wants attention, right? Every time he goes into the town, he's like, wolf, wolf, wolf. Everybody freaks out. Everybody leaves the town. Turns out every time, there's no wolf. Everything was fine. Everybody was safe. Nothing was to be worried about. Well, one day, a big old mean nasty wolf finally does come. And the little boy runs and he goes into town and he does the whole wolf, wolf, wolf. No one leaves. The whole town dies. Okay? Whose fault is it the whole town died? It's the little boy's fault, I believe. Because truthfully, the town would have believed him if he didn't lie so many times before. So when you're dealing with a person who has been doing the same actions since, in my case, 11 years old, he is going to be 29 years old in November. So you've done this for a very long time. And you continue to do the same exact things. You're getting locked up. You and this girlfriend fight and get beat up. You get put in jail for a domestic. You smoke crack with this person. You got a this. You broke into this. You got a robbery charge. So on and so forth. Okay? And all of those times, you didn't do it.
You didn't rob that store. You didn't hit her that time. You didn't smoke crack that time. You didn't sell crack that time. All of those things you didn't do. And when my situation, when it all first happened, hell no! He didn't do it! Support him, love him, guide him, kind him, hold him. This time will be different. Now he's out. Everything will be different. Everything will be fine. And then it happens again. Oh no, I'm innocent this time. And after the third, fourth, fifth fucking time of being, oh no, I didn't do it, you don't believe a person anymore. And now when he says in this situation, it's already been in the newspaper, so fuck it. So what happens is, I guess him and his girlfriend smoke crack. We have a situation. She claims she's beat up. He claims he doesn't beat her up. Needless to say, he is in jail, obviously, for a felony domestic, okay? And everybody is saying that, like, he couldn't ever possibly, he's such a great guy because he is a good kid. He's just a stupid ass shit and acts like a monster from time to time. And nobody likes this girl in my family. It's not a secret. It's not a secret at all. And so they have a domestic previously, and she recanted that situation. The last time he got in trouble, she came out and did the whole, no, I lied, it was a big huge misunderstanding, blah blah blah. Well, now this time we're all over the board. I choose to believe, I'm going to take her side until I'm proven differently, because I can't truly believe what he says, because we've already done this dance a million times. You know what I mean? Like, and you can't sit there and judge a family for not fighting and standing up for the quote-unquote wrongfully convicted when this is the 20th time he's wrongfully been put in jail. Ryan Ferguson never did a thing in his life that would make you believe that he would one day go out and commit a murder. But yet, it was very easy to convince everyone because one person said so. Easy for his parents and everybody to guide him and to help him and to have his back and everything else, because he never cried wolf. This was not the 10th time Ryan was in jail and needed help. This was the first time. This was the time the family knew 100% without a doubt he was innocent, and he was. And so fight for the rights, guys. Fight for your family when you know they shouldn't be there. Fight for the people that shouldn't be living in a legit hell, all because the state of wherever you are in doesn't want to say that they were wrong. And it's okay to be wrong, as long as you fix it. So, I don't know. I was just devastated. I can't believe that they do that to people. And that it's just so easily, you can be so easily locked up and forgotten. And everybody says that this can't happen to them. But it's like Kathleen Zellner says in this episode, and even like in my brother's situation, all it takes is one person saying you did it. That's all it takes. It takes one person and a crime to have, a situation to occur. May it be wrong or right, that situation, take it, run with it, and make up their own story. Someone can put you in jail for nothing. Those are the shit you need to be watching out for literally every day of your lives. And it's just sad. So, Ryan was set free, so that's good. And a little FYI, before we go to Thursday's situation, if you do not like brutal and blunt honesty, please already plan on skipping Thursday's episode. It will be my one where I talk on the video and talk to the peoples. And it's going to be really blunt. And not in a Sean Ray is going to be upset because someone gave her a bad review, Reway, or anything else. We're going to take on the topic of child sex trafficking and what that truly means. And I'm going to tell you a couple of
different stories of things that have happened to children and all that stuff. So if you're one of those people that like to not hear real true crime, even though it all is real true crime, but you like to have a nice little soft bow put on top and your feelings not to be hurt and for you to not have any bad thoughts or no think the world's evil or anything like that, skip Thursday, because I'm going to tell you things on Thursday that you will not be able to get out of your head. And truthfully and hopefully, I hope you don't, because I hope if I can put them into your head enough and make it be one of those things that you just sit there and when you're alone think, oh my fucking God, how are we letting this happen? That maybe there will be change. And so, like I said, if you are nice and of the faint of heart, please do not tune in on Thursday. I will not take back and I will not say I am sorry for any of the bluntness or the direct forwardness in the way in which I say things. So on that note, please follow me on Instagram at It Is What It Is Pod 19 altogether, no spaces. Twitter, It Is What It Is 208, because that's where I'm from. Facebook and YouTube, It Is What It Is, a true crime podcast. And yeah, like, subscribe, review my show, all that fun stuff. And I will see all of you lovely people on Thursday. Have a good week. Bye, guys.